Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
This is Red Box, the politics podcast from The Times. I'm Matt Chorley. Before we begin, a plea. Now, obviously, Red Box has been in your podcast favourites for ages, but now everyone is trying to get in on the act. To help us up the made-up iTunes charts, give us a rating out of five and post a review telling us what you think of the state of politics at the moment. And if you enjoy the show, tell your friends. If you don't, please keep it to yourself. This week, we cover students, iPhones and malaria, which sounds like a hell of a freshers week. I'm joined by Times columnist Philip Collins, who wonders why more billionaires don't do good. Nicola Walcock, Times education correspondent, on the latest expensive Tory plan to win back the youth vote. But first, I had suggested we ban talk of Brexit for a week, so guess what Daniel Finkelstein wants to talk about?
Labour presents its Brexit policy as a hierarchy. So first they'll push for a general election, and then if they don't get that, they'll push for a referendum. But this is actually not a hierarchy. They're moving between two completely contradictory policies.
I see what you're trying to do. You've tried to make out that this is about Labour, not about Brexit. So we'll let this pass through my usual bat. So just explain, I mean, given that the leader can't, but if you could just try to explain where Labour is on Brexit.
If there was a deal, the Labour Party say they would vote against it in order to try to force a general election. And only in those circumstances, if they lost forcing a general election, would they then move towards a so-called people's vote? They've never been quite clear what that people's vote might be. And they've suggested it's a sort of hierarchy of attempts to get democratic decision-making injected into the Brexit decision, or as if we haven't had enough of that already. But actually, these while they look as though they're moving smoothly from one policy to an even more democratic policy, they're really moving from a policy in a general election of continuing with Brexit to a different policy in a referendum of to oppose Brexit. In other words, Labour would campaign in the general election that they're trying to force in order for us to continue leaving. But if they managed to force a referendum, they'd campaign against us continuing to leave. So while these look like they're coherent building blocks and a sort of hierarchy, and that's the way that Emily Thornby presented them, in fact, they're an incoherent mess.
Is it totally clear that Labour would campaign to stay in that referendum?
The reason they've adopted this odd position is because of this second referendum. They talk about having a people's vote, they say they'll campaign for it, but they've always been very, very unclear at the top about what that referendum would be about. And they've come up with this idea, haven't they, which is let's have two propositions, you know, no deal and Theresa May's deal, both of which they oppose. So they'd be calling a referendum in order to oppose both options in it, which seems a bit weird. And they can't have that referendum, of course, unless the EU agrees to it, because it involves delaying Brexit beyond March in order to have us give us time to do it. And it's impossible to imagine the EU agreeing to have a referendum in which Remain is not an option. So this second stage is completely incoherent. And the reason this matters is that Joe Johnson, when he opposes any deal that Theresa May is proposing, is relying on being able to pass through the House of Commons some aspect of Labour's policy, presumably this second referendum. And I'm not sure, actually, that he's going to rely on them is a very good idea in these circumstances. I should say, because people know that I'm a Conservative, you know, this started with the Conservative Party calling a referendum. The Conservative Party is deeply split on it. Conservative voters voted for it. And we're having this debate because it was a project of the right. So I don't want to be the chutzpah person who blames this all on the Labour Party. But at this stage, you know, and so I do know, but at this stage, certainly some more clarity from the Labour Party would be helpful.
I think it would be incredibly welcome, wouldn't it, to have some really coherent opposition at this time when the Tories are so split and it's getting so close to the actual Brexit date. That's what's scary. Once Christmas is passed, we're going to be rampaging down the home straights, aren't we? And not only do we not have really a clue what's going to happen on the Tory point of view, but it's the one time when you would hope that somebody would stand up on the opposition side and say, this is our plan and this is what we're doing. And they seem, from my mind, just as divided.
Phil, do you think we'd be clearer about what the government was doing if we had a clearer opposition? Because in part, the government is able to be all over the place because the opposition doesn't have a clear line either.
No, not really, because I think the lack of clarity comes from the facts, not from the political positions that are struck upon them. I think it is some of these questions are completely unresolvable. The Irish question does not have an answer. The only thing you can do is to stop asking it and to think about something else and fudge it and forget about it and pretend that you've answered it and give an answer that which just about doesn't quite satisfy everybody. There is no answer. So I don't think clarity would suddenly be forced upon a government by a better opposition. Actually, up until this point, Labour's studied murkiness on Europe has served it very well. Served it well in the election where absolutely nobody had the first idea what Labour's policy on Europe was, and that is a very good thing to go into an election with, because it allowed Labour to hold together a coalition of people who wanted to reverse the referendum and those who'd voted for it who were Labour supporters. Now, obviously, as you get closer to the wire, that is an irresponsible position to keep, and I agree with both Danny and Nicola that Labour's position, it does embody a contradiction. However, in a way, so what? We can be pure about that, but so what? It's not their problem in the end. And if they, it's perfectly reasonable for an opposition to try and seek a general election, and they're going to try and get one.
The answer to the question, so I remember in the debate about nuclear arms, seeing this cartoon with two people walking down a road and a cruise missile's about to land in the next door street, and the caption as the two of them walked along was, come along dear, don't let's get involved. Right? So the truth is they live in this country, so they have to get involved at some point. And to be stuck in a position where they can't decide at this stage whether they wish Brexit to go ahead and do not go ahead, you know, is not a particularly good, between the leader and the rest of the party, is obviously
well, they're going to vote against the deal, aren't they? That is a very clear statement of intent, that they think this deal is not good for the country, and in all probability they'll vote against it, I'd imagine.
I think it would be a lot clearer and a lot easier for people to plan if they knew whether Labour was ultimately going to support a second referendum with Remain as an option. And I think that would make it clearer for people who were planning to vote on the deal what the consequences would be.
Of course it would, but then that would make the prospect of a general election, which is vanishingly small anyway, zero. So Labour's not going to reveal themselves to the Conservative MPs and help them make up their mind to be loyal to their own government.
Isn't it? Because what Labour is trapped in is actually a massive lie. It's a Remain party pretending that it supports Brexit.
No, because it's led by a Brexiteer. You know, I do think...
Is he really a Brexiteer?
Yes, I do think so. I think that although Jeremy Corbyn has decided to sort of give himself up to the party, you cannot take the he's taken a fundamental position on Europe for his entire career, which is that it's an anti-democratic capitalist club that's allied with the Atlantic Alliance and capitalism. You know, and that was why he didn't campaign in the European referendum, and why he now is doing all that he can to keep hold of the party, given where his base is in momentum, whilst not supporting a second referendum.
Do you think he secretly hopes it sneaks through and that gets him off the hook? He knows he's not going to get a general election, doesn't he, surely? Unless we've
Well,
it's
a general
chaos.
Rule when oppositions call for something, it's because they know it's not going to happen. It's like calling for someone to resign. Yeah. As soon as the opposition calls for cabinet ministers to go, they're safe, as a general rule.
He's still quite resolute in what he says about Brexit going ahead, isn't he? His interview with the Spiegel was very clear. I mean, it entirely contradicted Keir Starmer and Emily Thornberry.
Yeah, but exactly.
I know.
The fact that they're sort of saying they're not contradicting each other, but they clearly are, but nobody's explaining how it's not a contradiction. Within 24 hours to say two opposing things.
I mean, maybe the public have noticed. I mean, they are going down in the opinion polls. They are, even in the midst of political chaos, Labour's only polling 37%.
Which maybe is remarkable,
maybe that's partly the reason that people recognise this is a.
There is something absolutely astonishing about the polls, that given the total mess that the government seems to be in,
do you think
the Tories are still ahead?
Do you think that it's just that people have switched off from it?
I think there are a number of reasons. One, they're
as
quite
as
right.
Listeners have it, I don't
one,
mind.
One
of the things, we had a piece in Red Box this week from Matt Smith at YouGov, and he'd gone back and they asked lots and lots of questions about what do you think will happen after Brexit, if it's a good deal, if it's a bad deal. And the most amazing thing is that public opinion hasn't changed at all on Remainers or Leavers. They are still as diametrically opposed. You know, Leavers think their wages are going to go up, Remainers think their wages are going to go down. Mm-hmm. Food prices, you know, house prices, all that stuff. There has been no move. And part of me thinks, well, it's because you're right, they're tuning out. But at some point when this week comes to a head, maybe they'll tune back in.
The other reason why Labour is behind in the polls is because real incomes are going up. And people are not fixated with, which they were not in the general election. In the general election, they were going down. And people are not fixated with Brexit. The assumption that the government is in a terrible mess is one that you reach when you pay any attention. But most people don't.
The Conservative Party could avoid all this anxiety about the Labour Party very easily, though, couldn't it? The Conservative Party could simply decide to rally around its Prime Minister and vote through this scheme it's foisted on the nation. We could just do that.
I mean, it's a bit early to be drunk, Phil, this sort of radical idea of the Tory Party uniting around its leader.
Just a thought. They don't need to rely on Emily Thornberry agreeing with Keir Starmer or with Jeremy Corbyn or any of this. Well, they're the government.
My feeling is people who supported Brexit are not willing to make a good faith effort to implement it because they're after some deal that's completely unnegotiable. It's a bit of a cheat to expect the rest of us to have to vote it through.
It is a bit of a cheat.
Joe Johnson, who's always opposed Brexit, to take the position he does, but quite another for his brother, who supports Brexit, but somehow seems to think that when the deal is done, Joe Johnson and I should be supporting and voting it through while he votes against it.
Sure, I agree. Of course it's a bit of a cheat, and I understand the frustration of being in that position, and yet you're still confronted with the fact that you're running the risk, if this thing doesn't go through,
correct,
that we head out of the European Union with no deal, and at some point the responsible people have to be responsible, and I think they may yet still be responsible. And so, as frustrating as that is, correct, to deal with these people, nevertheless you still will be confronted with this decision. Do I vote for this imperfect deal, or do I take the risk of leaving with no deal in the hope that I get something better?
Do you think there's a group of that sort of such people in the Labour Party? In other words, that there are some people in the Labour Party who want a second referendum, who don't think this deal is better than being in the European Union, but who ultimately do think a deal is better than having no deal, and who, once the prospect of either a general election or a second referendum is gone, might then vote with Theresa May.
Yeah, I'm not sure there are many in the complete overlap you said, but I do think there are some who don't particularly want a second referendum and who don't particularly like the deal and who didn't want to leave the European Union, but who will vote for a deal in order to avoid the prospect of no deal. I'm not sure there are that many, but I do think there are some. So if the rebellion on the Tory side can be contained, then it passes with Labour vote.
Well, I've got a horrible feeling that we'll end up returning to this probably next week, because it feels like we're duty bound to. But let's move on and talk about something in the real world. This is Nicola Walcott.
Last week, The Times had a very interesting story, which got a lot of traction and follow-up, about possible plans for Tories to cut the university tuition fees to £6,500. Now, this sounds like good news for students, good news for their parents, who wants their children racking up huge amounts of debt at university. That appears to be the thinking of the party leaders, who may hope this appeals to voters. But universities argue very strongly that the losers are likely to be social mobility and the quality of higher education itself.
Nicola, what was so surprising about your story was that I thought the Tories had sort of slightly put this to bed. They tried throwing money at the tuition fees problem. It hadn't really got them anywhere. They made a very expensive announcement at Tory Party conference last year and almost nobody noticed.
Yes.
So it's like they have to keep going back and picking this scab.
Yes, exactly. They just seem to keep returning to it. And when you think about how much money and effort and energy went into trebling the fees in the first place in 2012, the anxiety over that, the uproar, when all that is said and done and is now starting to bed in and settle down, people are starting to see the benefits of that system And now to bring it up again, obviously people who are more political than I am will know more about the thinking possibly behind whether this is connected with Jeremy Corbyn's pre-election pledge in the manifesto to scrap tuition fees. But my sources did tell me that there was certainly a sense from Number 10 that they wanted to have something, if not to match that, then to go some way to having something to offer the electorate.
Isn't the problem, or at least the argument about going from 9,000 to 6,000, is it the only people who pay that extra three, if you like, back in the, over time?
Yes.
Are the most...
It's the most well-off students, most well-off families, who would probably pay the full whack.
Because if you graduate and then you end up in a job which you don't earn enough to end up paying it back, so you don't pay back that.
The threshold is £25,000. Yeah. And so if you don't ever earn more than £25,000, you won't pay back a penny. It's written off after 30 years. So changing the system to £6,500 actually benefits the better off graduates who probably would have paid more under the £9,000 system. But it won't really do anything to benefit those from poorer backgrounds or who don't go on to get very well paid jobs.
Sort of give me a five of politics, and it's, I'm afraid it is quite effective. And the Conservative Party, I am strongly a believer in the tuition fee system. I think it was the right thing to do. I'm in favour of very broad university access, and charging it in this way comes with it. There are questions over the interest rate. I think there are bigger questions over whether or not the system has forced universities to improve their quality, and that is something that I think the Conservative Party should be investing a lot of time in, how to force universities to give people value for their money at this very large rate. But you have to be pragmatic. So, first of all, you say that it gives the £3,500 effectively to the better off people. And probably those people are the most likely to vote Conservative. So, you know, again, looked at in a ruthless political sense, and here I'm not looking at it as in a policy sense, approving or disapproving, I'm just talking about the politics, pure and simple. You can exactly see why this policy would be effective with those people, even though, of course, it will not be as effective as planning to abolish it altogether, which I think is very effective politically, even if unaffordable and mad. It's obvious why they're thinking of doing it.
It's not just, people who think that the better off students won't suffer are very short-sighted, because universities, the quality of what they can offer would suffer. There would be less funding. Okay, there'd be less funding for widening participation, bringing in disadvantaged students. That's all well and good. But vice-chancellors I spoke to were also saying we'd end up with courses closing, larger class sizes, fewer resources, fewer able to offer expensive science and technology and maths courses, which are obviously what the economy and what the government wants. So all round, you would end up with poorer quality across the board.
It's not that surprising, though, is it, that vice-chancellors would say, no, we don't want our funding cut by a third?
Of course it's not. They don't want it.
Wouldn't the Treasury, for whom this may not actually cost that much because they're not going to actually raise much of this money back, simply give them money out of the putative non-gains, as it were?
I think that
in the end, what you get is a system which I think is less preferable, which is government funding universities rather than it following consumers completely. But
we've been moving away from that, haven't we?
No, I'm not in favour of that.
We've been moving away from government funding because universities, again, you say, yes, they say, we don't want to lose money. Well, yeah, who can blame them? But also, the trebling of tuition fees was such a massive deal across the board for everybody to get their head round. So far, it really has... Its effects are still being felt, still filtering through. The Office for Students, which was introduced last April, is putting a lot of pressure on universities to use a chunk of that tuition fee income to improve the university experience across the board. To then put that in jeopardy, you say that the Treasury would make up the difference. Well, the fear of universities is that that wouldn't be guaranteed in the long run.
And once the next time there's pressure for the NHS or whatever, then there's a
journalist, writer or policy person, you think, I'm very definitely against this, but you'd probably do it yourself if you were there in politics. I can absolutely understand why they've done it. I deplore it. But I think Danny made a very important point about the universities not responding particularly well to the gift of a trebling of tuition fees. I don't think their courses altered particularly, did they? And that's absolutely crucial. If you're going to introduce a kind of social market into the financing of university education, which I'm completely in favour of, then you have to respond to that. You have to have to change, and they didn't particularly. They just saw it as the necessary retrieval of underfunding.
And there has been, you know, a lot they could have done better. I mean, we've seen the huge hike in vice chancellor salaries, above 400 grand, not uncommon, just ratcheting up. And then obviously the strikes last year by lecturers over pensions. And both those could have been handled a lot better and a lot quicker, but universities haven't been quick enough to see themselves as answerable.
And of course, it's important to, in the context, because it's very important to get back to Brexit. And, and this is falling in the context of universities worried about students coming from overseas, which provide a very substantial component of their balance sheet. So at this particular moment, they're especially sensitive to a reduction in their income.
Yes, and they do punch above their weight worldwide and attract a huge amount of students from overseas. I mean, I think Matthew Lynn writing The Telegraph today reminded us 442,000 foreign students in the UK, a third of those from China, adding $25 billion a year to British GDP once fees and living costs are added. So any dilution of the quality, word would soon get around.
When tuition fees were trebled, and I remember, in fact, it was this time of the year, wasn't it? It was sort of the knights were drawing in and there was effigies of Nick Clegg being put on every street corner.
Yeah.
There was talk of it being up to 9,000 and it was all going to be open to the market.
Oh,
and
yes.
And then amazingly, it turned out no university wanted to advertise themselves. Knockdown cheapo.
I think there was one.
Was there
one in Leeds that offered a couple of courses, 6,000, and then soon realised that was...
The idea was that you might get people offering correspondence courses with exams offered by other universities, which actually, by the way, you know, that's why my father gained his degree originally. So I think that was the idea, and I think we need to push and explore why that hasn't happened, really, because it would be obviously brilliant if there was more choice of university options. And I, you know, there's a vast difference between the teaching quality in different university institutions. A market ought to reflect that in different prices or reflect it in something, but it doesn't.
I think there was a lot of anger in government that universities did just universally float to the top.
Yeah, it's not created a market, it's just filled a hole in funding.
Exactly, and I think it was only a year ago that universities assumed they'd be able to put their fees up to 9,500 this year. And we're talking about, well, actually 12,000 is the cost. Another really important point I think to make is that the biggest impact on students' purses and things which are causing massive anger and something which people could do something about are the maintenance grants were scrapped across the board. I think it was 2 years ago. So even the poorest students now have to have a maintenance loan. A lot of the time, even the maintenance loan that's given doesn't fulfil the actual cost of living. So people have to rely on their parents and not necessarily have parents in that position. The other thing causing a lot of anger is the interest rate on the tuition fees, which I think for the highest earners is now 6.3%. And there's, again, pushing across the board for that to be reduced.
But obviously it's like anything. And if we want to live at a certain standard, we'll all somehow have to pay for all these things. You know, we've, the Times are on a disturbing series of reports, you know, each of which properly sourced and true about the problems of extreme poverty and each of those things you want to address with financial solution. What I would want to address with financial solutions. This is another example where you don't want people to be paying a lot of money for. But the problem is we don't have money to pay for all these things. And actually, I find that is obviously the essence of politics. It's heartbreaking.
It's a shame we've got into an auction on university education, because that's exactly where we shouldn't be spending the marginal £11 billion. No, that is not a good use of public money to put it into what is essentially a subsidy to the middle class.
Oh, but we'll talk about it in the coming weeks. But the series that Danny was talking about, that Rachel Vester and Alice Thompson did, was extraordinary and absolutely compelling reading about what's happening out in the real world while everyone is fussing over what Jacob Rees-Mogg thinks about the backstop to the backstop. But we will come back to it. I also like to congratulate you all for it. We've spoken about tuition fees for 10 minutes and nobody's mentioned the Lib Dems. It's almost like we forgot they.
Yeah, you mentioned Clegg.
I mentioned Nick Clegg. We'll cut that out. In a moment, we're going to talk about what billionaires are doing, but we'll be back out of this short break.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back. This is the Red Box Politics Podcast on the Times. I'm joined in the studio by Daniel Finkelstein, Nicola Wilcock, and this is Philip Collins.
There is apparently a new phone. Or something. Some dreary new gizmo that will do things you don't need. This is the legacy of Steve Jobs, a man of no lasting consequence. Meanwhile, Bill Gates is showing how wealth and corporate ingenuity can completely change the world.
Where to start, Phil? On the iPhone is of no lasting consequence.
No, it's a phone.
It's more than a phone, isn't it?
No, it's a phone with an email on.
Okay.
It's not very... That's it. That's the full extent of what I have to say about this phone.
What is the new phone? Is it the X?
I don't know.
XS?
They're sending me emails.
iPhone 10, 11.
Dan sends me emails about them. An iPad. A new iPad.
A new iPad.
I did say a new phone or something. I covered that.
You just saw it from a distance.
There has been a new phone not that long ago, but
there's always a new phone. This is a perennial thing. I could do this script any week.
He blames all computing on me, I think.
I do. You early on in your career, you work for a computer magazine, and from then on, I've never let you forget it.
Yeah. So, we'll part the iPhone. Steve Jobs done nothing.
Yeah.
What is it that Bill Gates has done?
Well, I mean, the point behind this is not just for me to be annoyed at phones, although that's kind of, it's sort of important. it's that I actually regard Bill Gates as a hero who might become one of the great people of the 21st century, because what Bill Gates is doing with his money is changing lives totally in Africa. I mean, some of his work on attempts to eradicate malaria and polio, for example, is astonishing. There's the level of his commitment financially, but also personally, but in particular the method and application of his arithmetical and scientific procedures to the eradication of problems is really extraordinary, and the progress they're making is immense. And he may well eradicate some major diseases in sub-Saharan Africa within our lifetime, which is an astonishing thing for someone to have done with their corporate wealth. And there's lots of examples of 19th century Americans, Carnegies and Rockefellers, doing great things with their surplus returns. And Bill Gates, to his great credit, and Warren Buffett, who deserves an honourable mention, is in that honourable tradition. And that contrasts with lots of people. This is an era in which you can become ridiculously wealthy for doing essentially nothing. It's the first time ever. By which I mean, I mean, Steve Jobs is an entrepreneur, so I'm not denigrating him in that sentence. I mean that there are people who, in financial services, who are just employees, taking no entrepreneurial risk, with no great creative ingenuity, are immensely wealthy, beyond the dreams of avarice. And that congealed wealth could do immense good in the world, and Bill Gates is demonstrating that.
I looked up, because you were talking about, you know, the amount of money that is donated. In 2016, donations worth more than £1 million in the UK totaled £1.83 billion. In America, £83 billion. In America, it was £270 billion. So even allowing for the fact that obviously are more Americans, by my maths, and this might be wrong, it's about £27 per person in the UK and £800 per person in the US. What do you think is behind that?
Well, the classic explanation for that is that the book by Frank Prochaska is the welfare state. The absence of a welfare state in America has led to an increased role for philanthropic giving. So that's usually the explanation for why those traditions were different. I'm not sure I entirely buy that, but that's one possible thing. You've also got a lot wealthier people, a lot more successful entrepreneurial class in America. But nevertheless, it's something we should encourage. In Britain now, we have got more... Our wealth inequalities are enormous. Our income inequalities have been stable for 30 years. Mm-hmm. But wealth inequalities are vast now. And there's an awful lot of idle assets, and that money could be put to really good use.
With universities, there's certainly a massive difference in the UK and the US with the philanthropic giving. And UK universities have got whole teams now set up to try and encourage this legacy of once you graduate, even when you're earning peanuts, you donate a little bit each month. And
because the American universities, of course, they exact the quite a heavy price, don't they? Because you actually buy places for the dull offspring of givers.
This is true.
Ivy League universities are an absolute racket.
I mean, I know that I basically agree with Phil's thrust and even his caustic wit about the phone. Obviously, truthfully, Steve Jobs was a very, very innovative entrepreneur, and he did create a new market, effectively, the market of the mobile device that had various different smart options on it, and that's changed reading and communications, all sorts of things that it's done, and it's been very important in the development of social media, the smartphone. So it has been profoundly consequential. But first of all, it's odd that Steve Jobs was sort of seen as the kind of great, heroic, lovely guy, when actually every piece of evidence was that he was horrible to almost everybody who worked for him, and even his own family. And that Bill Gates has never received quite the kind of the public praise and the sort of adulation, effectively, that his behaviour deserves. And not only because he himself has been an incredibly important entrepreneur and in the creation of Windows and other things, certainly at least
Jobs is equal, possibly more.
So I think there's an argument on both grounds, because some people question how significant Bill Gates' contribution of DOS and all that really was. But okay, but nevertheless, I certainly think he's at least equal.
I told you about it. You can see why I blame him now.
It might be the first time we've ever had DOS mentioned out there. Do you think it's also partly the sort of just the public perception of the two men and their products and their businesses? Is that Apple is all sort of sexy and shiny and turtlenecks and all that sort
of
stuff?
Jobs is in show business. Well, no, it's a profound change. It's a difference of philosophy. So Bill Gates has made his money and also development in computing on an open platform so that lots of people could plug into it. That means why it's spread all around the world, but that means you can't control what you produce. And Steve Jobs was a control freak, and he created a closed system. And the closed systems have all sorts of problems, both economically, as he discovered by driving Apple into the ground once before making it successful, but also when you use it. And there's a lot to be said for Bill Gates as a pioneer of open systems, actually.
I mean, there's a good point you make about the adulation that Jobs receives, which I find remarkable. I mean, Walter Isaacson has written biographies of Leonardo da Vinci, Albert Einstein, and Steve Jobs. I mean, that's just not the company this guy should be keeping. He is, into the bargain, the worst renowned public speaker in the history of the world. His commencement address at American University.
Have you seen Chris Grayling speak?
Chris Grayling is Demosthenes to this moron.
Well, that's interesting. I was at dinner with Steve Jobs.
He came away with a bag of foams.
He was actually incredibly compelling, but also managed to insult at least a third of the audience to such a point that the next day, someone had to apologise to him. The point about his closed system is that it's in this way he's slightly comparable to Walt Disney. He was trying to create a sort of world, and it's very compelling, the world that he creates, and the control means it can be beautiful and self-contained.
Well, that was a lot about it, wasn't it? The design, the design of the first IMAX. It was all down to that, but it's the substance underneath it.
But I am ideologically, I'm much more for open systems, and so are you, which is why you're more attracted to Gates. But that's before you even move on to the question of their charitable impact.
Even on the terrain of computers, Gates is the man.
Never forget all your malaria nonsense.
But getting back to philanthropy, obviously in Victorian times we had massive philanthropists, not just in America, but here. So what's changed? I mean, you say the welfare system, but there doesn't seem to be that great culture anymore. There's a university in Hereford, engineering university, and they're looking for a big philanthropist. They're going to name themselves after them.
I think what happened was a change in the conception of the company. Yeah. So the philanthropists you've probably got in mind are the sort of chocolate philanthropists of the Cadbury's and Bourneville and all of that, the Quakers. And they had a conception of a company as a part of the society in which it was hosted.
And paternalistic.
And that idea of the joint stock company changed in the late 19th century and into the 20th century.
But it's also about the diminishing utility of money, right? So if you've got a few people who are extremely wealthy, at the top end of their wealth, right, if you've got £100 billion, £1 million is less consequential to you than you've got £10 million, and giving it away doesn't mean so much to you. One of the reasons why there are big philanthropists in America is there are a lot more extremely rich people. And when you're extremely rich, you're more likely to give. However, of course, it is notable, and one should pay attention to this, that richer people proportionally tend to give less than poorer people. That's a very disturbing aspect of philanthropy. So it's partly about culture as well.
Can I tell you a joke about Rockefeller?
This seems like a good way to end.
Exactly. It's a Two Ronnies joke. And Ronnie Barker and Ronnie Corbett sit in the garden, and Ronnie Corbett says, "If I was as rich as Rockefeller, I'd be richer than Rockefeller." And Ronnie Barker says, "How do you make that out?" He says, "I'll do a bit of window cleaning on the side."
I think it should be a new thing. We always finish on a joke. Yeah. I'm afraid that's all we've got time for this week. Before we wrap up, a reminder to post a review on iTunes. Subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Acast, or whatever fax machine, or whatever it is that you get your podcast from every week. But for now, from Daniel Finkelstein, Nicola Walcott, Philip Collins, and me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan, and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts, and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.